Thank you very much for inviting me here. I'm very pleased to be in Australia once again. I've been here several times before, but I must say that this is probably the best time that I've had in Australia, and I think it's certainly due to both the organizers of this event and your own generous work. So thank you. This particular talk, people ask me how many times have I given this. I will tell you this is the first time I've given this talk. There are some elements of it, perhaps, that I have mentioned from time to time, but this is a brand new talk, so please bear with me when I stumble on it. I like the phrase here, venimus, vidimus, dola verimus, which basically means, we came, we saw, we hacked. Now, I'll give you a warning, okay? When I give these types of talks, and as a keynote talk, it's always supposed to be something which is enlightening, futuristic looking, and stuff like that. Absolutely no technical content whatsoever. There's therefore a lot of opinion in it, so those of you who say, but, you know, well, that's tough. So the overview of the presentation is going to be a little bit about a certain tale of courage that I recently read in a book, and I'll talk about that later. A little bit about what really makes Linux unique from my viewpoint. Then a little bit about how does this interact with all of us. And finally, a little bit of questions that you can ask me, all sorts of questions, even personal ones. And if they're too personal, I'll just refuse to answer. When I was coming here, and this is to give you an idea of how new this talk is, when I was coming here on the airplane, I stopped by the bookstore and picked up a book called October Sky by Homer Hickam. And it used to be called Rocket Boys when it was first published. It's recently been made into a movie, which they actually were showing on a plane that I was recently on. And the book was about this young boy growing up in Colwood, West Virginia, in the United States. Now, if you've ever been to this part of the United States, basically during the 1920s and 1930s, it was a very productive place. They had huge coal mines, and they were generating lots of coal for a burgeoning steel industry in the United States. After a while, the coal started to run out, and these places started to die. And the people were caught kind of in the middle. They had no place to move because their houses weren't worth any money anymore. And, you know, basically they were kind of stuck in this dying, poverty-stricken area. Well, this particular town of Colwood was still going strong. And this boy who was growing up in that town, his father was very strong about him staying in the coal mining business. But instead, he had heard about these rockets that were being fired off. And this is the beginning of the Sputnik era in the United States, where Russia was launching Sputniks and we were trying to catch up with the Vanguard rockets and things like that. And there were about six boys in this little group that taught themselves rocketry and taught themselves the mathematics to do rocketry. And because of this, they acquired a certain amount of fame throughout the whole area, and they made their entire town very proud of them. And so the book is about how over time the town turned from kind of hostile towards these people who would say, you know, what are you doing? You know, why aren't you playing football like everybody else? Why are you sending up these rockets that set fires to fields and people's houses? And one rocket, they literally blew a corner of the office of the mine that his father worked for. Blew a corner of the building completely up. But still, you know, they recognized the fact that there was something these boys were doing which was certainly interesting. And eventually they went on, all of them, to go on to college to, you know, to be productive citizens and stuff like that. And yes, eventually Homer Hickam actually worked with Wernher von Braun's team in launching rockets. And so, and I have a quote here that really struck me in the book. The future was somewhere else, not in Colwood. I had to get ready for it. And it struck me because this is Linux. So I'm going to take you back in time a little bit, back to the time when I started in computer science, and some of the people in this room may remember some of this stuff. But when I started in computer science at Drexel University in 1968, there was this monolithic computer that you had to use. If you wanted to do any type of serious project, the computer was so expensive that it took three University of Pennsylvania, Drexel University, and Temple University to come together to afford this computer system. You would schedule time at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning at a low priority to run your job, because if you ran it at any other time, it was too expensive to run it for you, the lowly student. Professors, and particularly senior faculty, of course, got to use it during the daytime, but even they had to schedule their time. And even with all of this expense and all of this so-called power, the computer was actually relatively small. I believe that that particular computer had about 128K words of memory in it. And again, in a lot of the early computers, there was no real concept of having a disk. Most of the time it was tape-to-tape type of storage, or you had a drum that was very small in size. Then, in about the early '70s and late '60s, a new type of computer system came out, something called the mini computer. Okay, and computers started to move out of the glass house, where you would take your deck of punch cards, which you had laboriously punched and looked at to make sure that they were okay. You know, a favorite trick of the upperclassmen was to take one of the new cards that had no punches in it, turn off the printing mechanism of the card punch, punch one hole in it, and then put it back in the stack of new cards. So you would then be keep punching away, you know, and you'd keep punch your character on top of that, and of course there was now this one extra hole, which the printing at the top in no way reflected, okay? The printing on the top of the card no reflected. Only the printout that you got 24 hours later would show you that there was some strange character in the middle of your deck, and then you'd have to justify why this character was printing as one thing on your printout and something else on the card. Yes. But in any case, the mini computer allowed you to move it out of the glass house and have something that sat in front of you and you could actually program yourself. And it didn't cost millions of dollars, it only cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. Now, to put this in perspective, sometime later when I graduated in 1973, I bought an entire Toyota pickup truck for $5,000. And today, that pickup truck would probably cost $20,000 or so. So you can see that something that cost $100,000 back in those days was quite expensive. But also, at the same time, a new phenomenon started to be created. Computer user groups started to show up. And one in particular that got my attention was one called DECUS, the Digital Equipment Corporation User Society. One of the reasons why I was interested in it is because one of the mini computers that I had access to at Drexel was a PDP-8. And it had an ASR33 teletype, which would laboriously punch out paper tape at the rate of 5 characters a second. It would also print at 5 characters a second. And so that's how fast your output could come out of the computer. And lo and behold, this group of people at this far-off society that I was too poor to go see would actually send out free software, or at least freely distributable software, because it was software that you could purchase for the cost of production on paper tape. And so I would scrape together $5 of my beer money and send it off and get back an editor or an assembler or something along that line that was punched out on this paper tape that I could then freely reproduce and give to somebody else if I bought a blank paper tape and ran through the ASR33 teletype. So, in reality, This is the very first part of computers becoming more personal. They were no longer locked behind the glass wall. They were becoming something that you could touch and feel and work with. And of course, this generated lots of new languages and programs and games and things. I still remember the first time I ever played Star Wars on a computer called the Link 8 computer. This was a kind of a neat computer because it had this older style of computer called the Link, which is a very useful computer in doing medical types of work. It had a lot of analog to digital converters on it and things like that. However, it was frightfully expensive to build. And then it had the PDP-8, which was relatively inexpensive to build at only about $100,000. But it didn't have all the neat things and the neat language that the Link had. And so what Digital did was bring the two of them together. And the Link computer would actually pass the information about what instruction it was going to execute to the PDP-8, which would then emulate that in the PDP-8 and pass the answer back to the Link. And so you had the cost differential of the PDP-8 in with the interesting instruction set of the Link. And they had this little program on there, this tiny little oscilloscope with this tiny little triangular block with two little jets that came out the back. And this was your rocket, okay, that would go blasting through space. And by pushing one of the buttons on the keyboard, you could toggle it to fire little bullets at another little rocket that was coming through. And the two people would sit there with a couple of rheostats on this side, rheostats on that side, shooting the rockets through space and trying to shoot each other. If you got really good, realize the fact that if you were close enough to the edge of the oscilloscope when you fired a rocket, the rocket would come in from the other end of the universe and blast the thing. So your opponent would think they were safe being behind you, right? And all of a sudden this rocket would come in from the edge of the screen and blow them up, and they'd be really pissed. And of course, there were lots of new operating systems that were developed, but they were simple operating systems because these are really small memories. And so people could experiment around with what were thought of as operating systems at the time. Now, in commercial computer science or commercial computers, we talk about the elbow of what people are willing to pay. There's certain elbows that exist in selling things, okay? Anybody who's in the sales situation thinks about the elbow. And the elbow is where if you charge more money for it, there are fewer people that can buy it. If you charge less money for it, there's lots more people who can buy it. And so the goal of this is to create the certain type of margin you can have to maximize your profits and get the most profit coming in. And that little place right there is called the elbow, okay? Well, it started to come about that as computer manufacturers started to manufacture these computers, you had an elbow form of probably about, you know, $70,000 or $80,000. And so you tried to stay in that computer elbow to get people to buy those computers and keep the manufacturing lines going. And so as the price of computers started to drop, people tried to put more and more things into these computers to keep up the price and so to keep up the profits. And so you started adding in more memory and these things called disk drives, and the disk drives got bigger and so forth. But if you went too much, if you put in too much stuff, then you found that fewer and fewer people bought your computer system because they simply couldn't afford it in their budget. And you'll see more about this later on. So about 1975, the microprocessor comes in. And for people that remember that time frame, there were things like the Altair 8080, okay, which had a, you know, lights and stuff on the front cover, and it was great. And this is the first kit computer that used a microprocessor, and people bought them by the droves just to be able to say they had a computer in their house. They had no software in it, but they had a computer, okay? And after you got finished putting it together, you put it proudly on your table, and your wife came past and said, "What's that for?" And you went, "Mm-hmm." And so, you know, and then other kits came out, you know, you've probably heard of these, KIM-1, the Altair, you know, all these different computer systems came out. And again, the prices were dropping. For people that were in the, quote, real computer fields, you know, the people who were working in places like Aetna Life and Casualty that had two of everything that IBM ever built, you know, in special order, and who were out buying the memory at a megabyte at a time. I still remember the time that the chief executive officer of Aetna Life and Casualty, now this is the largest multi-line insurance company in the world, sent out a letter to every single one of his 30,000 employees, a paper letter, that said, good news, we just bought the second megabyte of memory for IBM mainframe. Now today, if the CEO of Aetna sent out a letter to every single employee saying we just bought a second megabyte of memory, they come along with a long jacket with long sleeves and lock the poor guy up and send him away, okay? But at that time, the second megabyte of memory was a huge amount of money. And the microprocessor came in, and memory prices were somewhere along the lines that if you bought 4K of memory, you would pay $400 or $500 for it. Which, when you put them in a landfill, can pollute water, stuff like that. There's a covering on the CRT screen which is made of lead to protect you from the x-rays that would normally be coming out. And that lead covering getting into a landfill could really create bad things. There's mercury in batteries. There's PVCs and covering on wires and stuff like that. Part of their trying to keep them out of landfills is to recycle these computers. And you can find people who can get a, or are willing to sell you a 486 100 megahertz system or a low-end Pentium 100 megahertz system, 32 megabytes of main memory, a gigabyte of disk for $50. And people snap these things and use them as Linux systems. I was over in Korea talking with the department head of computer science at a Korean university. I told him that I would like to go to China in a few weeks to start talking in various areas of China about Linux. And he goes, oh, you won't find much Linux in China. I said, why not? He says, because the Chinese students can't afford computers like the Korean students can. He said, their parents don't make enough money. They can't afford them. And I said to him, you mean they can't afford new computers? And when I said new computers, the look on his face was one of astonishment because he hadn't even thought about the used computer market. And this is what has been happening, that people will buy these used computers in the United States, ship them unfurbished over to China. The Chinese will refurbish the computers and sell them for $50 or $60 and use them. And Linux runs very nicely on these. Windows 98 does not. Not only that, but you probably have heard a lot about Chinese people and piracy. And Japanese people in piracy, and Korean people in piracy, and Vietnamese people in piracy. I went to Hanoi, Vietnam a couple years ago. This is the first time I'd been in Vietnam in a long time. Actually, I spent 5 years of my life trying to stay as far away from Hanoi as humanly possible. If anybody ever invites you to go to Hanoi Hilton, it's okay now. Back when I tried, was first involved with Vietnam, it wasn't okay. In any case, in Hanoi, Vietnam, 2 years ago, you would get in this little bicycle known as a cyclo, and a driver would pedal you across the town of Hanoi, the city of Hanoi, from one side to the other for a quarter, 25 cents. And then he would beg you to pick him when you came out of your meeting, pick him again out of all the other cycler drivers so he could pedal you back across town for another quarter. And you say, well, I'm going to be in this meeting for 3 hours. That's okay. It's all right. You know, just as long as you pick him when you come out, he will wait for you. He will be your cycler driver. And now this person who's probably feeding his family of four on a dollar a day, feeding, clothing, housing his family of four on a dollar a day, you come up to him and say, oh, please pay $600 for Microsoft Word. Oh, sure! They were over cycled back and forth 1,200 times, right? Yeah, that's the type of marketplace. So, and you say, well, these people are pirates. I can't tell you how much they hate the word. I have left things inadvertently on the steps of a temple in Japan that, if it had been New York City, 12 seconds later, it would have been gone. I've come back a day later and found the thing very carefully picked up, placed up on a wall, out of the way of people walking, and it was still there, waiting for me to return. How can you say that those people on one side are so proud that they will not steal something which is there, and yet so unproud on the other side to steal software? It's because they can't justify in their minds how in the world they could ever possibly afford this tiny little plastic disc which somebody is asking $600 for. With Linux, they don't have that problem. How do you steal a free operating system? It's very difficult. And these people are now begin to say, yes, I can use Linux and it's free. Another thing you have to think about is the hardware-software price. It used to be hardware was a thing that was extremely expensive. Software wasn't cheap, but hardware was the thing you bought. These days, it's reversing. Think about how much you pay for your hardware of your computer system and how much investment you have in the software of commercial software. I have a friend of mine that one copy of his software for doing VLSI design cost $250,000. And they run it on a Spark system. And he said, can you convince my management to move it to Linux? And I said, okay, the Spark system costs $10,000. A comparative Linux system would be $4,000. There's $6,000 the difference in between. Do you think your customer who's just shipped out $250,000 is going to care about a $6,000 savings?
Nah.
People say to me, Mad Dog, behold, is using computers. And I say to them, is that really true? Because if you count up the number of licenses that Microsoft has sold, and they'll tell you, it comes to about 200 million Microsoft licenses, most of which are Windows and some of which are Windows NT. There's about 9 million commercial Unix systems, about 2 million of the Star BSDs in usage, 2 million proprietary systems, MBS, BMS, AS400s, things like that. About 15 million Linux systems, and whether you agree with that number or not is inconsequential. Just say it's 12 million, let's say it's 10 million, doesn't make any difference. Which adds up to about 228 million general purpose computer systems in the world. But there's 5.6 billion people, which means that 5.4 billion people have not selected their operating system yet. So our goal, your goal and my goal, is to reach those 5.4 billion people before Mr. Bill can brainwash them. B5OFUM, this slide kind of got out of order. I talked about this a little bit already, okay? The other part about this is to talk to people's military. Now, China has not always been friendly towards the United States. We had this little, problems back in the 40s and 50s, you know, and then the Vietnam War thing, you know, they were supplying North Vietnam, we were supplying South Vietnam, and, you know, there's some tension between us. And there still is. We inadvertently blow up their embassy. They think we did it on purpose. You know, we didn't do it on purpose. Not that I know of. The thing is, would this country really trust an operating system that came from a country that hasn't always been their friend, and not only that, but comes from this one company that's under the control of this one individual who hasn't always shown extreme stability? And, you know, if I was them, I wouldn't do that. For heaven's sakes, you know, I'd want an operating system that maybe 2 or 3 million of my own people had looked at the source code, and maybe in time of war they could actually help me change it or modify it to meet my needs. Okay? I'd do the same thing if I was Australia. You know, it's only recently that we actually put Britain on our list of most favored nations. Before, you know, it's just a short time ago, we wouldn't ship any type of cryptology stuff to Britain because, you know, we couldn't trust them, the United States, I mean. You know, after all, we did have that bout with them in 1812. And so, you know, again, for some of these emerging countries, Linux would make a great operating system. As an example, I'll go back a little bit. Recently, two things happened to me. I got this letter from this person that said, I'd really like to build a Beowulf system, but I don't really have good connections with the internet. It's very hard for me to pull this code across. It's even hard for me to read about it because I only really have electronic mail access. Could you send me some information about a Beowulf system so that I could build it? And I said, well, that's a reasonable request. And I happen to have a copy of Red Hat's Beowulf Extreme Linux distribution here. I could send it to him. So I answered back, sure, no problem. I didn't notice that the last two letters of their internet address was CU, which stands for Cuba. The United States has an embargo against Cuba for the past 50 years. We're not allowed to ship them even postcards, much less how do you build supercomputers? And so I get to the post office and I'm filling out all this forms and stuff about customs and shipping and stuff like that. And I get down here and it's at that point I realize this address is Cuba. And I'm stuck with this moral dilemma. I had promised this person I was going to send them this code. On the other hand, I'm sending it to this country that my State Department says I shouldn't be sending it to. So what do I put down on the form as what I'm shipping? Music CD. Shortly after that, I meet this other group of people. They are also from Cuba. They have put together a medical network inside of Cuba. The reason is that the medical books which they had or have are getting so frayed and so old, they can't get new medical books. They can't afford them, and it's hard for them to get them. And so the old books, which they had been passing around to the different hospitals, were becoming too old and frayed and were too costly to reproduce. So They're putting it all on inexpensive PCs. They formed a network of 1,600 PCs throughout all the doctors and hospitals, and they're all using Linux. They had to get their Linux distribution from Chile because they couldn't get it directly from the States. But Chile was kind enough to sell them a copy. Maybe they even gave it to them, I don't know. There you go. So, why is Linux unique? These are different things that have happened to me that helped me describe why Linux is unique. I was at CeBIT, the largest computer show in Europe, if not the world, and this man showed up in front of me. He said, "Are you Mr. Hall?" I said, "Yes." He says, "You represent Linux International." I said, "Yes." He says, "That's good. I'm here to pay for my copy of Linux." I said, "Pardon me?" He says, "My partner in my business pulled this copy of Linux over the internet and put it on our computer system. And I am here to pay for it because he stole it." I said, "Sir, he didn't steal it. He couldn't steal it because Linux is free." And the guy said, "Linux is free." I said, "Linux is free." He says, "Linux is free?" I said, "Yes, sir, Linux is free. Linux is free." And I left him. He was just wandering off going. Another unique thing happens. At Linux Expo, the last Linux Expo they had, no, I'm sorry, it was Atlanta Linux Showcase. Atlanta Linux Showcase, the last one they had. The Debian people were setting up their booth, and they had shipped all their computers and all their handouts and all their CDs and everything to the show site, but they found out much too late that all of them were getting there a day late to set up their booth. They should have been getting there a day earlier. And so what to do, they had all the airplane tickets set up and everything, and this person wrote to the Debian mailing list and said, "I'll set it up. I live locally, I'll set it up for you, and I'll hook up all the networking. You tell me the networking numbers and everything, I'll hook it all up, and I'll have it all working and set up by the time you get there." And they said, "Oh, this is great." So they did that, and they showed up at the site, and they found that the person who had done this was 13 years old. Had not even occurred to them to ask this person, "How old are you?" And he had done such a good job that he remained the systems administrator for the rest of the show. Oh, the trademark nightmare. I'm part of the trademark nightmare, okay? As some of you may be aware, a short time ago there was a thing where somebody in the United States had trademarked the term Linux. I was trying to get money out of the different Linux distributors and stuff for the use of the term. This, of course, was completely bogus. So we hired a lawyer and took this person to court and eventually got the trademark transferred to Linus in the United States. And we're proceeding to try and get it transferred to him from different countries. It's interesting dealing with Linus and the trademark, because Linus says, "I want to protect the trademark so everybody can use it for free." This goes directly against the trademark laws of the United States, which specifically say that you're supposed to be protecting the trademark because it belongs to you as one entity, okay? And so we have to do certain things to protect the trademark, to show that we are actively protecting it and actively saying how it should be used. On the other hand, we're trying to freely give it away so people can use it. So just a word of caution here. For all of you who would like to start a Linux business or a Linux thing of any type, please do me a favor. Number one, just send me some email with capital letters in the subject line saying, Mad Dog, the idea for my business name is eh, okay? And I will try and answer back as quickly as possible, giving you a thumbs up or a thumbs down. The major rule of doing this is put enough adjectives around the word Linux that makes your thing really unique. For example, I want to be the South Australia Linux Freeware University. Don't just say, I want to be the Linux University, okay? Because there may be other lots of Linux universities in the world, and we don't want to limit that number. But if you say, I'm the South Australia Freeware Linux University that only meets on Thursday and Tuesday nights. That's really good. We'll get a stamp to you right away, okay? The Linux Company. I can't tell you the number of entrepreneurs who come to me and say, I want to invest in the Linux Company. I'm sorry, sir, there is no Linux Company. Well, there's got to be a Linux Company, because I hear about it all the time. Linux is every place. There's no Linux Company. There's Red Hat, there's SUSE, there's Netcraft, there's all these other companies you can invest in them. You can approach them and see if they'll take your investment. But there's no Linux Company. What about Linux International? That's great, we don't sell anything. Well, that's a stupid company. Yes, it is. Compaq. As you know, for many years, I was at Compaq, I was a digital first, trying to promote Linux, and then Compaq bought us. It was in September of last year that Compaq decided that they were going to do Linux. Upper management said, yes, Linux is the right thing, we should be doing this, come out with a strategy and everything. We announced the strategy inside the company, and all hell broke loose. Why did all hell break loose? Well, the thing is that Linux is so open that anybody can do anything with it. And we had like eight different organizations inside of Compaq, some of which made notebooks, some made servers, some made Intel servers, some made Alpha servers, some made workstations, Intel workstations, Alpha workstations, all separate groups with all separate management, and they all said, oh, I can go off and make a deal with Red Hat, SUSE, And all of a sudden, we go, whoa! Because you're all coming out with different messages, and these people over here said, I'll put Linux on there and run it for 5 minutes, and that piece of hardware is qualified. And the other group over here says, oh, we got to run Linux on here for 89 hours and 12-15 gigabytes of memory and all these disk drives, and that's qualification. And there was no real message. But that's the beauty of Linux, because you can go out and you don't have to ask people's permission to do something with it. You can go ahead and do it, except for the trademark thing. Remember that. This is bringing about a new set of entrepreneurs in the computer science marketplace. And as a good example of this, I was told a couple of weeks ago about these two 14-year-old gentlemen. Actually, they're 15-year-old now. But when they started, they were 14 years old. They formed their own company. They created their own distribution. They released it at the age of 15. 2,000 people sucked it down from their website. They had people contacting them, trying to invest money in their corporation. And their parents didn't even know about it. And so all of a sudden, they had this guy, Jeff Gerhardt, who runs a radio station up in Canada, and is a friend of mine. He calls them up and says, calls up their parents and says, hi, you better sit down. I want to tell you, what your sons have been doing. And so now they're in the process of trying to set up a trust fund so all the money that's starting to flow in from this company can be channeled off to this student's college fund. But how could they do this? Simple. Because they could. Because it was free. because they didn't have to answer to anybody to do it. And so this is entering up with a whole series of untapped resources for us. When people ask me, how can Linux keep going on the way it has? It's because we haven't even started to tap the resources that are really out there. As it grows, it becomes more and more used. There'll be more and more people who will pick up the torch and say, yes, I can write this little piece of software. I can do this. I can help these people use it. I can help them understand Linux. That's because it is not their operating system. And the other night, when I was sitting there trying to figure out the real difference between Linux and the BSDs, which I could never figure out before, it occurred to me that the problem with the BSDs was that there was this core group of people, and it was their operating system that you used. And the entire time that I've been using Linux, I have never felt that it was somebody else's operating system. It was my operating system. It's your operating system. It doesn't belong to anybody, it belongs to everybody. And that, I think, is the real difference. Nobody was ever told, no, you can't work on this because it's not yours. They're encouraged to work on it. Linus has always said, send me a patch. I may not put it in, but send it to me anyway. Show me the code. It's always a statement. Show me the code. And if you don't like it, and he said this many times, if you don't like it, then start your own. Make it real time. And by God, it's a real time project. Make it into a supercomputer, and the Beowulf stuff came about. Make it into an embeddable system, and all of a sudden it runs on a Palm Pilot. Slowly. And you can't invoke Emacs. And so there's a sense of ownership to Linux that I don't think happened with the BSDs. The BSDs were a project that was started by some other group of people. And so the question comes about, and this is the last point of my talk, is what can I do to help with Linux? And the answer is anything you want. And for those of you out there who can write code, then great, go to it. But you don't have to write things only in the kernel. We're looking for other things, like some nice demo programs to help, you know, show off Linux. I still remember the first time I installed Yggdrasil Linux onto my PC. And as it booted up, it ran two MPEG demos, and the PC speaker managed to squeak out the words, hello. It was the first time my computer had ever spoken to me, and I was hooked. Even if you don't write fancy demos, write some plain demos. Or write some example code about how to use Linux and put it out there. I think that one of the strongest points of Linux are the fairly aggressive set of how-tos and mini-how-tos. Oops. And screensavers. Write documentation. If you don't understand the documentation, then please simplify it, okay? Get it out there. Review the documentation. Some of it was written some time ago. Make sure it still matches up with the latest releases. Join a user group. Better yet, start a user group. And people say to me, oh, I don't know enough about Linux to start a user group. Let me tell you something. The best people who run the best user groups are not technical people. They're good planners. They set up the room. They set up the room. They get the mail out on time. They're consistent. You know, they're relentless in going after speakers. They're bulldogs. But they may not even know how to code a line of C. That's fine. They need to.
One of those people, please come up to me later.
But they need to listen to the people in their group to say, what do you want to hear about? And they need to be aggressive in going out and finding the people to give the talks. Create presentations for a user group. You know, it doesn't have to be the most complex thing in the world. Sometimes it's stuff you can do for a new user.
you know.
If you haven't used a piece of code before, you're new to that piece of code, whether or not you're the most experienced kernel hacker in the world. Okay. Secure Shell is a good example, as I struggle to use it. Start what we call, in our user group, NUN Nights, New User Nights. The joke that we tell is, are penguins come this far north into New Hampshire? You say, well, I don't know. Oh my God, I ran over something black and white out there, it could have been a nun. Train people on how to use Linux. And the challenge I always put forth to an audience is, in the next year, I want each one of you to train two new people on how to use Linux. And make them commit that the next year they'll train two more. And then get them to commit to training two more. And just like the person who, with the Chinese emperor, asked for a grain of rice in the first square and two in the second and four in the third and so forth, and the emperor said, oh, absolutely. And there wasn't enough rice in China to cover the 64th square. Then we would really have world domination. And so, in the final part of this, I will simply give you one more quote from the book, October Sky. Sometimes one dream is enough to light up the whole sky. And I think that Linux is that dream, and I think we should go forward. Thank you very much.